The best salespeople are often the least salesy, right? It's the consultative, you know, it's just like you. It's your ability to ask great questions and show interest and help the client lead to the solution.
Plug into the minds of the world's cutting-edge innovators, visionaries, and thought leaders who are rewriting the rules of sales and success. It's your time to make an impact. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast. Welcome back, everyone, to the Selling with Love podcast. I'm particularly excited about the conversation we're going to have today because it is a topic I'm not very familiar with and I'm so curious about. And what we're going to be talking about is the concept of franchising outside of the food industry. You've heard of franchises probably as a consumer going to them, but what does it look like if you were an entrepreneur and you're wondering, what path should I choose? And is franchise something I should consider? What are some of the advantages, criterias, roadblock, pre-qualifiers? I'm very interested to know this because so many people have a desire to build something great and are looking for a recipe to help them get there in the most effective way. Perhaps franchising is a path that's been neglected that we need to investigate. And the man that I'm bringing on to have this conversation with is John Ostenson. He is a top franchise consultant, author of the book Non-Food Franchising, and CEO of Franbridge Consulting. He helps clients understand all the aspects of non-food franchising. And I think it'll be particularly interesting if any of you have an idea and you thought, what would be the next step for me to scale and grow fast? Perhaps being in the franchise business is a model you haven't even considered and is extremely possible for you to navigate that business model. We're going in with a curious soul. We're going to see where sales applies and have a lot of fun in this conversation. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jason. Excited about the conversation.
As I mentioned, I feel like I'm a student on this conversation. I'm aware of franchises, consumer, we think McDonald's. I think Tim Hortons, I'm from Canada. So like, I know a lot of people who own Tim Hortons franchises. And again, the bias being that it's mostly in the restaurant field that I feel that franchises have a huge footprint. So I'd be very curious about, you know, what are the biggest misconceptions there? And maybe just open it up on what got you so interested in the topic?
Absolutely. No, there's a world of franchises out there. There are about 4,000 franchise companies in North America alone, and about half of those are in the food space, about half are in other industries, things like home and property services, health and wellness, categories like kids, pets, seniors, so many different niches out there that, again, are not top of mind. But I will say from where we sit, we're seeing a growing awareness out there, and so more and more activity. Know a little bit about my background and how I really stumbled into franchising. You know, like so many of your listeners, I spent many years in the corporate world and had a good run, very thankful for those experiences and was in different sales capacities along the way. But then about 8-9 years ago, had the opportunity to step in and run Shelf Genie Franchise System, which was a large North American franchise system. Custom pullout shelving for your kitchens and pantries was the crux of it. I served as their president, ran our home office, supported all these franchisees across North America, and really fell in love with the franchise model. I just saw how all these diverse backgrounds could come together under a shared system, learn from each other, get a playbook. You know, we were supporting them, a really kind of a built-in team, if you will, and go out and become business owners and be successful. So long story short, I eventually split from there with the founder. We invested in other franchises ourselves on the franchisee side. And now I spend most of my time helping other entrepreneurs and investors do the same.
I think it'd be very good for people to understand, you know, especially the fact and where my ears perk the most, as you mentioned, that health and wellness is a niche which a lot of franchises do exist. What typically is the kind of prerequisite or the foundations that are in place that would make somebody say, hey, maybe this model is something I should consider? Is it because you have a capacity for business, you lack certain skills in business? I'd be curious to know the profile of someone who should consider this as a model.
You know, 90% of our clients enter into an industry that was never on their radar, one they don't have any background in. And so it's a lot of fun to take them through the process and see those light bulb moments in real time where they're realizing, hey, maybe this makes sense and I can transfer my skills to your point. So I'd say transferable skills is the biggest piece. And really, end of the day, the most successful franchisees are willing to follow a system. There's some degree of humility, right? They don't want to be the smartest guy in every room that they're in. Yeah, there's some humility to say, hey, it's a proven business model. I'm going to step in and go execute it. And then number two, you have to be halfway decent with people. I mean, that's just business 101. You've got to be someone that people want to work with or work for and work together on. So, you know, I'd say those are the biggest things. When I was a franchisor, we loved franchisees that had any sales in their background. Again, not that they're going to be the tip of the spear in that new business, but they at least know what it looks like. Sales is such a piece of so many of these companies, and to be able to know how to hire and incentivize and retain and coach sales talent is such a key skill set that I know many of your listeners have.
Well, definitely a lot of my listeners would like to nurture that skill within them. And I'm glad that you're praising the trade of sales, given that usually sales gets a very negative bias on a consumer level. I'd want to dig in a little more to highlight what are the key reasons why you see sales as one of those skills that's so essential for someone that's even going into business, not directly into sales.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, it's, the people piece of it, right? In business, you've got to have that. And yeah, I'm so thankful to have sales in my background. And I've spent a lot of years consulting as well. And yeah, I think consultative sales. I mean, end of the day, where it gets a bad rap is the salesy type, right? But the best salespeople are often the least salesy, right? It's the consultative, it's just like you. It's your ability to ask great questions and show interest and help the client lead to the solution. So I think about industries like home and property services. I mean, that's a $600 billion a year space, so many niches. I mean, some of the ones I'm personally invested in, just as an example in there, would be a business that does parking lots, asphalt paving and line striping. I've got another one that provides temporary walls, like containment walls around construction sites. End of the day, both of those are B2B sales oriented, right? And, I've got some other ones, even in the health and wellness arena. I've got one that's custom orthotics. We produce 3D printed insoles, for your shoes, very custom. That's more of a retail storefront, but still there's a sales orientation to it. You're trying to get people to upgrade and not only make the purchase, but make the higher end purchase. So yeah, so many different niches out there. Those are just some of the ones I personally own that have a sales bent.
I'd be curious to understand one of the major differences that could exist between going towards a franchise model, help me with the terms. Franchisee means I'm buying into a model that I'm going to apply in my location. Franchisor is the person that owns the model, right?
Right.
I'd be curious to know, as someone who's considering franchisee, what are some of the similarities, differences to consider compared to something like a direct sales business model? Because I feel like there could be some similarities.
Yeah, I think it would be the ownership and the fact that you're building an asset that one day you'll be able to sell. I'd say that's probably the biggest piece. And, franchises actually trade at a higher multiple upon exit than non-franchises in the same space, because that resale buyer sees the value. And very oftentimes these never even hit the open market because they're bought by other franchisees within the system. That internal M&A is very common. But I'd say that's one core piece. Obviously, you've got the shared brand, which you might in the sales system as well. Shared brand, shared resources, support coming in. And then a percentage is going back to the franchisor or to that sales corporate, if you will. So there are definitely some similarities to your point.
And then from there, I'd be curious, as somebody who might have a current business, maybe have a practice, and I have to pick into an industry that I know a lot of my listeners are in, which is like wellness, coaching. And there's a lot of people that are currently being certified as independent practitioners for any kind of methodology, and they're getting certified into that. I'd be curious into, what would stop somebody from actually going further and saying like, hey, what if I become a franchisor instead of certifying people for the practice, give them the opportunity to own this brand and to like get clients and receive the system? Are there a lot of barriers to become a franchisor? Because it seems like huge barriers in my head.
There aren't a lot of legal barriers. There are legal, you have to produce an FDD, a franchise disclosure document. It's big, long, boring legal document now, and franchise attorneys help with that. And certainly we have all those resources. We can point clients to the right spot. But, really the biggest thing I would say are two things. One, you've got to be capitalized because it does take money to franchise, right? It's not a get rich fast approach. Now, private equity loves franchising. It could be a great deal long term, but early on, it takes a while for those royalty streams to build and, anything flowing back to you. Secondly, in addition to being capitalized, you've really got to have a support team. If you're going to invite people in to become franchisees of your system, you've got to really have the support dialed in. And if you don't, and you set improper expectations with those new franchisees coming in, you're going to have some headaches down the road. And I've seen that firsthand. I think some people get excited about franchising their business while they're still kind of building the plane in the air, and they don't have the team to support those new franchisees, because end of the day, their success equals your success. So you really want to be stabilized and be able to support them the way that they need to be.
That sounds like a healthy time to do it. And definitely a warning for anybody who's wanting to rush into it, not the case. So in this case, I'd be very interested into what was the big reason why you've delimited yourself or at least niched out with being non-food franchises. Is there a significant difference between that and the rest of the franchises?
you know, we need the food guys. We love them. We support them. Some of them do very well. But my humble belief is there are easier ways to make money. You know, there are a lot of opportunities out there that require less operating hours, maybe fewer hourly employees, you know, less capital expenditures on the front end to do the build out. And they may be less susceptible to consumer whims as well. You know, with food, I think, you know, if you're with one of the big brands, again, you can do very well. If you're with one of these more upstarts, it's risky in the food space. And even like we look at frozen yogurt, you know, I always point to that as an example. Froyo was big until it wasn't, right? And so people's tastes can change. And that's where a lot of our clients just like these businesses that are less trendy, maybe recession resilient, things that people will always spend on. You know, again, just think of like the property services arena, whether it be flooring or dumpsters or roofing or cabinets. I mean, that stuff's not going to go out of style. And oftentimes it can carry higher margins as well because you don't have the food waste that you have, you know, the food space. So again, for me, there are easier ways to make money. Probably 95% of my clients would agree with that. And so I decided to cut out half the market so I can go deeper on the other half. And I think that was a really strategic move that's paid off because, again, we attract a lot of people that are interested in other industries outside of food.
John, I say this with tongue in cheek, but it sounds like the types of industries that are most fun for franchising are also very boring businesses. Is that a fair statement?
If you're a reader of the Wall Street Journal, I don't know how many articles on boring businesses they've run in the past year, but I joke that non-sexy is the new sexy when it comes to business ownership. It is riches in the niches, and it's things that, you know, I have a lot of clients, they'll reach out, they say, hey, if I can make a few million dollars a year selling porta potties, I'm up for it.
Yeah. And it's crazy because again, and I'm using boring for effect, but it's like, these are all industries that just happen seamlessly in the background. And you're saying that there's opportunities that exist because there's a lot of regional application of these core industries that just need to exist for functioning in a city. And when you go through a franchise model, you come in with a business model that's operationally much more effective than whatever is locally being offered. So then you get to grab a lot of client base, have systems that prove that it does work. You have the support. That sounds really fun. So then the question I'd be asking is, what does somebody need to have if they're trying to get into this? Like, I'd assume you have upfront costs. You have, is it industry knowledge? You talk about the soft skill, but like, there's definitely going to be some stuff that needs to happen if you're going to consider this, right?
Absolutely. So first off, from a financial standpoint, I just had some clients buy 10 trampoline parks the other day. Those are $3 million each. That was a big deal. Most people are not going that big. In most cases, when you look at the franchise fee and your startup cost and several months of working capital all built in, so you're all in investment range, you know, oftentimes you're in the $150,000 to $300,000 ballpark. That's where a lot of things fall. Certainly quite a few opportunities that are more retail-based just north of that. But for a service-based business, that's where it falls. And there are multiple ways to fund that. Some people will use all cash. Most of our clients like the idea of leveraging, so they'll put in maybe $50,000 of cash and then use an SBA loan. Banks obviously prefer lending to franchises. It's more predictable, so SBA loans are very, very common. You can also use your retirement plan if you want to tap into that and roll that over through what's called the ROBS program and actually purchase the business that way too. So, you know, a lot of different ways to fund it. And, you know, as far as finding that opportunity, because if you start Googling out there, you're going to see a lot of noise. You're going to come across, hey, a top 50 franchise list, a top 100 franchise list. Most of those companies are actually paying to be on the list. And so it's just a PR move. And so again, a lot of noise out there. And that's where we come in. We have the deep industry relationships. We see what's going on behind the curtain and essentially act as a real estate broker, but for franchises. And so our model is we don't get paid by our clients. Our clients never pay us a fee. We simply get a referral fee on the back end from the brands when a placement happens. None of that's passed on to our clients. We work with over 600 different franchise companies, part of the largest brokerage in North America. And yeah, just great visibility that we're able to provide to our clients that they wouldn't have otherwise.
I find it interesting when you compare to real estate, because obviously one of the great levelings that happen in real estate is you have the MLS, the multiple listings service, where you know if a property's there, it's been through some sort of like vetting process, realtor, to get the property up on the market. There's a lot of regulation that makes it so that if you search there, you should be getting at least 90% of all properties that are for sale. But then I compare it to Bali, and Bali is very interesting because it doesn't have a centralized real estate area. People are doing long-term leases. Things are complicated. You got to go to specific websites to find. It's chaos here. But in the chaos lies opportunity if you got your boots on the ground. And it sounds like franchises are kind of in between that. It seems like there's a lot of mystery around it, which is kind of why it becomes an opportunity. So I'd be curious to know the maturity of the market.
Yeah, you know, franchising is regulated by the Federal Trade Commission, FTC. And so every year, every franchise system has to refile their FDD, franchise disclosure document. That's all the history. That's what the investment looks like in detail, any historical financial results. It's called the item 19 within the FDD. But there are a number of different sections. So again, the goal is to allow candidates to get as much information as possible up front. So they get the FDD, they're going to get a chance to talk to other franchisees in the system before they ever buy, so they can hear about their experience, ask them questions. You know, we certainly hold their hand through this discovery process. You know, we've got them meeting with the franchisor, having conversations on different parts of the business. Really, you know, there's no perfect due diligence, but we get pretty close to it. So much better than if you were to just go out and buy a resale of an existing business. Here, you've got things where, you know, they've been audited, the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, and, you know, so you're able to go in eyes wide open.
Very interesting. It's, you know, I think about a business that is not franchised, and the number of ways that it could be sophisticated to non-sophisticated is a very wide range. Like, you could have a business that doesn't even keep track of its books, still operates, and it's just super sketchy. But it sounds like in franchising, because you have this disclosure document and there's some, it, like, is it comparable to like being publicly listed? Or I think the barrier is much lower than being publicly listed, right?
I'd say the biggest similarity to, I mean, public listings, I mean, that's crazy what they go through to get to that point. But so I'd say it's less, but it's moving in that direction. And, you know, the biggest thing there is, again, the audited financial results. Also, you know, the franchisor has to be careful not to make earnings claims in the same way that a public company can't come out and guide around their earnings outside of what's in their release. It's the same way with the franchise system. So if it's in their FDD, they can speak to that, but they can't come out and say, hey, our margins tend to be a little bit higher than what's shown in the document. You know, that's illegal. So now the other franchisees in the system, they can open up their books and share whatever they want. But from a franchisor standpoint, they've got to kind of, you know, toe the line when it comes to making earnings claims.
Every business today is an online business, and you're going to need a website. If you're using WordPress, you're going to need to host it on a powerful website host that is lightning fast, works all the time, and can give you human-to-human support in the process. That's why today's sponsor is Kinsta, and we're going to encourage you to check out their incredible offer for those of you who need a reliable host for your website. Ready to experience Kinsta's hosting for yourself? Get your first month free when you sign up at Kinsta.com today, and it's the perfect opportunity to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses worldwide to power their websites. Visit Kinsta.com to get this limited time offer for new customers on select plans. Don't miss out and get started free today. This is such a fun conversation because, again, this is poking into an area that I've never really looked at before. And I'm hoping for everybody listening, I know this is a little off the topic of our usual sales conversation and looking into the personal growth industry, but this to me is kind of like this hidden gem that most people might not be that aware of. And if you're trying to find that opportunity, and there's, God, you're talking about non-food industry, and there, I said some of them are boring, but I bet there's some of them that are really interesting, fast growing. I would think in the wellness space, there's probably some very interesting examples, and maybe you could share me a few of them that could be interesting for people to consider, given that majority of my audience is probably in the health and wellness space here.
Yeah, you know, I just had a client the other day that bought, or he's going to be starting 5 locations of a business that provides multiple recovery services under one roof. So you've got the infrared sauna, the cold plunge, the red light, cryotherapy, you know, a few other modalities all under one roof. So one-stop shop, membership-based, recurring revenue for you, the owner. And then, you know, so that'd be a sexier, fashion-forward type one right there. You know, we've done a lot of placements in the in-home senior care space.
Hold on. With that one you just said, would it be called Hacked Fitness by any chance?
No, Degree Wellness is the name of that one. Yep. But there are several out there with some similar approaches, right?
Well, this was an old friend that I know has Hacked Fitness in New York, and I know had ambitions to go to the franchise model. And if it was her, I would have been so excited. So a little shout out to you, Pam. Love you. Thanks for listening. But yeah, it's like, this is exciting. Like, if you're into health and wellness and you're considering this stuff, I'd be curious in that example of the gym before we move forward is like one single location you're trying to pop that up. Is that the one that still falls in the 150,000 to 300,000 category?
Yeah, I'd say in the case of that one that I just mentioned, that would be probably more 400 to 500.
Because the equipment, right?
Yeah, a little higher end. And when it's customer-facing retail and you have a build-out, it's going to be a little higher priced. And about half of those that we represent are in that space, but the other half are more remote. And a good example of that in the health and wellness arena is in-home senior care, in-home health, as we call it. Obviously, there's a never-ending clientele that continues to get older out there. And Yeah, it's all about recruiting caregivers. But I mean, talk about sales-oriented business. You're selling, you know, to the customer, oftentimes the kids of that aging parent, but also to the caretakers as to why you're a better employer than others. So, I mean, their sales comes in multiple capacities. I had some clients recently buy into that up in Boise, Idaho, and they came back 6 months later and said, hey, John, business is going great. What's another business that they can complement what we do? And you see a lot of this work. People will tag on different businesses, build this little empire. And I introduced them to one that provides wheelchair ramps and stair lifts and mobility solutions, you know, in the shower, in the bathroom, throughout the home, so that people can age in place. Talk about a great complement to that in-home senior care. So it's fun when you can get creative and kind of say, hey, how can I leverage, maybe it's the same customer base, or leverage the same employees and kind of shift them around to different types of businesses. I've got some clients that will go, you know, totally diversified. One of our clients is the largest franchisee of a 2 minute in a truck moving service, operates in about 12 different markets, does $45 million a year in revenue. And over time, you know, he's continued to buy up other franchisees in the system, build this organization. And every year or two, he comes to me and says, hey, John, I've got this young guy that I want to promote. He's proven himself. What's a good franchise that we can help him buy into, and we'll help fund it? And so he's just created this really neat stream of attracting talent, giving them paths to promotion within, and even giving them equity to go start their own thing.
This all sounds really cool, man. I would love to maybe put a realistic, sobering conversation here, which is, we obviously know this is not going to be something where you make all your money overnight, but I'd be curious about what is a reasonable time frame when someone puts in $500,000 that they'd be starting to get their return and then getting into the green from the initial investment.
And I always tell people, hey, if it was easy, everyone would be a business owner, right? I mean, it takes a lot of work and it's not a passive investment. About half of our clients, though, go owner operator, where they jump in full time day one. And certainly if you're doing that, you're probably going to ramp a little bit faster. You're probably going to get those returns sooner. The other half run what's called, franchises call it semi-passive, semi-absentee, executive model. Those all mean the same thing. I like to call it semi-involved because you're still going to be involved. But that's the idea that you put a manager in place to run the day-to-day, maybe while you keep your day job. And you know, because of the support of the franchise, supporting that individual, it does allow for you to be a little more hands-off, especially over time. In that case, you know, to receive that return back to you because you're paying a manager, it takes a little bit longer. So I'd say, to answer your question, it kind of depends on which model you go with, but you know, let's just say you go with the owner-operator, and most people that do that have the goal of eventually replacing themselves, and then they move on to the next thing. In that case, oftentimes you see margins. I'll just give an example, and this is one that shows what's possible. I'd say it's on the more attractive side. I had a number of clients buy into a gutter business, installation of gutters, again, kind of non-sexy space. All in investment on this one, you're probably $200,000, $250,000, and the average revenue in that system's about $1.2 million. And they're averaging about 25% to the bottom line. So a little higher than margins than some, but that'd be $300,000 to the bottom line on an initial investment of, call it $250,000. That's pretty good return that you're making every year, right? And you're building a business that one day you'll be able to sell as well. And you're getting the tax benefits of being a business owner. So it's kind of that trifecta that I call it. But yeah, it's not that you're achieving that $300,000 to the bottom line in year one, though we have had clients actually hit the $1 million mark in year one, get off to really fast ramps, but always want our clients to go conservative in how they build out their pro formas. And yeah, you know, it may be, you know, you get to that run rate at the end of year one or at the end of 18 months, you know, and start working that way.
Lovely. One of the things I want to open up on is, because I have a diverse audience that's maybe from around the world, myself being Canadian as well, do you see some particular areas that it's much more, I don't know, is it convenient, safe, or has much more barriers to entry for going into this model in countries around the world, whether that's Europe, Canada, or major areas?
Yeah, no. In fact, Canada is very big in franchising, and the UK is as well. I've spent some time with some founders over in the UK, and we actually just had a franchise in the freight logistics space. 50 franchisees in the UK, they just entered the US. I've got, I think, 15 clients talking to them now. It's a really neat opportunity for salespeople, actually, sales background. You know, certainly franchising is big in India, you know, throughout parts of Asia as well. I won't claim to be an expert on the regulations over there. That's a little bit outside of my domain. But, you know, if there is interest in those other parts of the world, unfortunately, we focus on North America here. That's just what we know. We got to stick to that and go deep. But I'm sure there are professionals over there that can help as well.
I find it so funny, and I said this before we hit record, is having a conversation like this must feel very similar to your usual sales calls that you would have with somebody considering getting himself into a franchise. And I'd be curious about what would be the similarities and differences from one of your traditional sales calls, someone saying, I may be interested in franchising, I have some questions, in the conversation here. Just curious to hear.
I do my best to get to know the client. I feel like I've been talking about, you know, I don't like to be selling. I like to be consulting and answering their questions. But no, I think on a typical sales call, if you will, I would be getting to know the client a lot better. And, you know, most people have read my book, Non-Food Franchising, which I'm happy to share with all of your listeners. Most of them have read it. It's pretty easy to read, about 90 pages. I pack a lot of content in there. So by the time we get on the phone, we're having a very informative conversation. We're able to kind of move at fast pace. And most of those I work with are mid-level to senior level, and they don't have a lot of time. And so we really cut to the chase and start talking about real opportunities that could be available for them in their market and start taking them down that path.
Which is where I kind of want to shift gears on this conversation. So for anybody who's interested in the franchising model, I'm going to recommend everyone grab a copy of Non-Food Franchising. Reach out to us. We'll put a link so you can get a copy. Go and follow John and send him a message. Say you heard this interview, you want a copy, and he'll be able to send you that. What I would love to switch gears on now, John, is understanding like how you started getting into the business of being this brokerage that's getting people into franchising. And you already talked about how writing the book has become a key component of your marketing, right? Like that's, I'm just breaking the fourth wall here because that becomes very interesting as well. And so I'd be curious, is that where the majority of your leads come from? How do you get people to discover about your book? I'd be curious to understand that part.
Absolutely. So, you know, I approach things very differently. There are thousands of people that do what I do out there. You know, I'm not a lone wolf, but they go about it very different. They buy a list of leads. They pick up people through portals online. That's not my style. And so most of my leads come through people that have heard me speak or heard me on a podcast, or they read the book, or about half my business is referrals now. Again, we're just known in a lot of different circles out there. So very blessed that it's more of what I call magnetic marketing, where we put out great content and people are drawn into that. So no, Non-Food Franchising the book came out about 2 years ago. All the proceeds go to Hope International, which is a great nonprofit that we support. So it definitely wasn't intended to be a moneymaker, but it has achieved bestseller status. And really it's done everything I hoped it would do. And that, again, people are educated and they're able to learn more. You know, franchising was not on my radar back in the day. I know it's not on the radar for many, but it is on the radar for a good number out there. Our biggest challenge right now is not clients. We've got plenty of clients. That's never been the challenge. It's opportunities move so fast in good markets. They sell out quickly. So I am constantly working my relationships, trying to get early dibs on new opportunities. Because in a market like Atlanta, where I am, it sells out almost immediately. So that's where we spend a lot of our time, is more on the supply side than the demand side.
Interesting. And so in that case, what is it? Do you have to discover like who's just listed their franchise that are looking for new franchisees and just keeping a pulse on that, getting kind of early in on when that's coming out, where the details are going to be type of thing?
Yeah. I know the heads of a number of different franchise groups out there that represent different types of companies. I was at a conference in Charleston last month and learned about one, the freight logistics one coming from the UK over to the US. And so I kind of worked an angle to get early rights to that one for my clients. And yeah, it feels like a race at times because there's so many reasons why people want to be business owners today. I mean, even real estate investors, a lot of our clients invest in real estate as well. I personally do, but there's very few good real estate deals to be had right now. So everyone's moving over looking for other alternative investments that are tax advantaged and check a lot of those same boxes, and they're discovering franchising. A lot of people still, years after COVID, that kind of got the wheels turning about one day I want to be a business owner. They've been consuming content. They've been thinking about business ownership and learning more. But until they realize that franchising can be a better path and they start connecting the dots, that's kind of, again, where their light bulb goes on. They say, hey, maybe this is doable. So it's getting more and more attention out there.
I was speaking earlier about the differences between, you know, listing of properties, maybe in the US or Canada, where there's a lot of regulation compared to the type of market that exists here in Bali. But again, because it's so chaotic and you know what you're doing, there's some bigger opportunities, but there's a lot more risks as well. My background's actually in real estate investment. So like, I've got the love for that and the simplicity for that, but it's also a very mature market, particularly in America, which comes with, you know, the returns and the opportunity starts becoming much more level if everybody knows how to get into it and the barriers to entry aren't that high. I had a guest come on the show, Jay Abraham, and he was actually talking about how to buy businesses, like just not franchise, which had huge potential opportunities, but you definitely need to come in with your own set of tools that optimizes that business. You need to have a lot more research and you need to be, you know, bringing in a skill set to turn a business around, to acquire it and turn it around in a powerful way. Yeah, huge upside, but you need to know what you're doing and you don't know what you're getting yourself into. And it sounds like franchise is kind of in the sweet spot where it's eliminated a lot of these risks. It's given you some blueprints that have been proven, but it's still a little underground that it's got some nice juicy margins that exist that for a lot of people, that might be the cup of tea that they've been looking for.
I love how you position that. And I would totally agree. Most of the people reach out to me and say, hey, I've been looking for an existing business to buy for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Some of these have even hired full-time analysts to go find the business. They've been under LOI three times, four times, five times. Due diligence didn't shake out. They got outbid. Something changed. It's a needle in a haystack. It can be a great proposition, but you're going to spend a whole lot of time trying to find it. And then once you find one, you're typically paying a premium for the business, assuming that everything stays the same as it has historically. But whenever you inherit someone else's team, someone else's customer base, things change. There's risk that oftentimes people overlook. Then they say, wait a minute, with franchising, it may take a little more work in the very beginning. You know, it's getting it off the ground. But again, it's a proven model. It's all about going out and executing. But I get to pick that team. I get to put my thumbprint on it. I get to put my culture, you know, thumbprint on it. So many of them that have been searching, and they call themselves searchers oftentimes, are now coming over to the franchise side. So that's another group that's crowding the space.
Love it. I mean, we have you as a resource right now. And so obviously this conversation, this topic on the podcast is much more niche and specific, but since we have you here, perhaps this would be the best time to actually share some of the things to maybe look out for, some red flag that we should pay attention to if we're getting into this and we're doing some research. Maybe we can't work with you because we're in a different market, different country. Are there some things you should definitely be like, hey, make sure to check these things before you decide to go to jump into any of these opportunities that might exist?
Yeah, from a high level, certainly the financial model's got to be there, especially if they have a small sample size of locations. You know, you want to make sure there's enough meat on the bone that even a conservative estimate still makes it an attractive proposition. You know, competitive advantages, you know, how are they going to differentiate themselves in the market, you know, versus the competition? You know, what are their current franchisees saying? That's probably as valuable as anything. And then I put so much weight in that leadership team. You know, if that leadership team only has industry experience but hasn't brought any franchise experience around them, that'd be a little, at least a yellow flag in my opinion, because supporting franchisees is a whole different animal. I like to see that combination of industry and franchise experience. Certainly some of the things we talked about earlier, making sure that franchisor is well capitalized, you know, making sure they've got a robust training program. You know, the question is, what value are you getting from the franchisor versus you going out and starting the business yourself? Is there a true tangible value that you can point to and say, hey, that's worth the royalty stream that I'll be paying back to the franchisor? So yeah, you just want to go in and be very inquisitive. And you know, I'd say nothing forecasts the future like the past. And so, you know, really digging into the reasons why maybe their financials changed year over year, or why did they lose a franchisee? You know, what really happened? So yeah, you just want to never underestimate the due diligence.
John, I came into this conversation as a very curious soul. You have satiated that curiosity, actually probably fed it even more, because I do feel like this is maybe a very, very powerful place to start looking at some opportunities that we never started looking before. So I'm very grateful you came onto the show and you got us to get curious about this. And I know, again, I have to preface the fact that we are a little off the usual topics I have on the show, but you know, it's my show. And sometimes I get curious about these topics. And I remember you coming into the inbox and I was like, this is a fascinating topic. And I'm hoping for everybody paying attention. If you're just thinking, I have energy, I want to make an impact, I'm ready to, you know, roll up the sleeves and put my energy into something that's proven and fun to do, this might be the model you need to look into. I certainly feel excited about it. And I'm definitely going to do a little bit more research to see if this is going to be my thing. And so it's just been an awesome conversation. I'm so glad I brought you on. I can't let you go before I ask you the question I ask everyone that does come onto the show, which is, you're on the Selling with Love podcast. What does selling with love mean to you?
Yeah, I think it's being very prescriptive and obviously non-pushy. And, you know, when I was in the corporate world, I go back, that's where I got my start in the sales world. And, you know, I grew a book of business from about $250 million to $350 million in a very short time. And that was not from being I'm not a salesy guy. I'm not a used car salesman. It was from coming in, being very prescriptive, using analytics to show the customer what I was trying to get at, you know, and partnering with them. It's all about a partnership.
John, Thank you so much for everybody tuning in. If this topic was as interesting to you as it was to me, you're definitely going to want to grab a copy of Non-Food Franchising, connect with John. This will be a primary resource for you to consider franchising. I think it's a fascinating world, a fascinating model. And if you've been looking to find a sweet spot where there's not too much competition and great opportunities, this might just be it. And so I'm very glad we had you on the show, and thank you for sharing everything with us, John.
Great. Thanks, Jason. Enjoyed it.
I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.